When he was done, she said, "What was the name of the old weaver?"
"The slave?" Drasdan shifted his weight, frowning. "She was, Elsa, it might have been, or Ella. It was 6 years ago she died. I have owned so many slaves, Your Grace."
"Let us say Elsa. Here is our ruling. From the girl you shall have nothing. It was Elsa who taught them weaving, not you. From you the girl shall have a new loom the finest coin can buy. That is, for forgetting the name of the old woman."
Resnick would have summoned another Tokar next, but Danny insisted that he call upon a freedman. Thereafter she alternated between the former masters and the former slaves. Many and more of the matters brought before her involved redress. Meereen had been sacked savagely after its fall. The stepped pyramids of the mighty had been spared the worst of the ravages. But the humbler parts of the city had been given over to an orgy of looting and killing, as the city slaves rose up, and the starving hordes who had followed her from Yunkai and Astabor poured through the broken gates. Her unsullied had finally restored order, but the sack left a plague of problems in its wake. And so they came to see the queen. A rich woman came, whose husband and sons had died defending the city walls. During the sack she had fled to her brother in fear. When she returned, she found her house had been turned into a brothel. The whores had bedecked themselves in her jewels and clothes. She wanted her house back and her jewels.
"They can keep the clothes," she allowed.
Danny granted her the jewels, but ruled the house was lost when she abandoned it. A former slave came to accuse a certain noble of the Zak. The man had recently taken to wife a freedwoman who had been the noble's bedwarmer before the city fell. The noble had taken her maidenhood, used her for his pleasure, and gotten her with child. Her new husband wanted the noble gelded for the crime of rape, and he wanted a purse of gold as well, to pay him for raising the noble's bastard as his own. Danny granted him the gold, but not the gelding.
"When he lay with her, your wife was his property, to do with as he would. By law, there was no rape."
Her decision did not please him, she could see, but if she gelded every man who ever forced a bed-slave, she would soon rule a city of eunuchs. A boy came, younger than Danny, slight and scarred, dressed up in a frayed grey tokar trailing silver fringe. His voice broke when he told how two of his father's household slaves had risen up the night the gate broke. One had slain his father, the other his elder brother. Both had raped his mother before killing her as well. The boy had escaped with no more than the scar upon his face, but one of the murderers was still living in his father's house, and the other had joined the Queen's soldiers as one of the mother's men. He wanted them both hanged.
"I am queen over a city built on dust and death."
Danny had no choice but to deny him. She had declared a blanket pardon for all crimes committed during the sack. Nor would she punish slaves for rising up against their masters. When she told him, the boy rushed at her, but his feet tangled in his tokar, and he went sprawling headlong on the purple marble. Strong Belwas was on him at once. The huge brown eunuch yanked him up one-handed and shook him like a mastiff with a rat.
"Enough, Belwas," Danny called. "Release him."
To the boy she said,
"Treasure that tokar, for it saved your life. You are only a boy, so we will forget what happened here. You should do the same."
But as he left, the boy looked back over his shoulder, and when she saw his eyes, Danny thought,
"The harpy has another son."
By midday, Daenerys was feeling the weight of the crown upon her head, and the hardness of the bench beneath her. With so many still waiting on her pleasure, she did not stop to eat. Instead, she dispatched Jiqui to the kitchens for a platter of flatbread, olives, figs, and cheese. She nibbled while she listened, and sipped from a cup of watered wine. The figs were fine, the olives even finer, but the wine left a tart, metallic aftertaste in her mouth. The small, pale yellow grapes, native to these regions, produced a notably inferior vintage.
"We shall have no trade in wine."
Besides, the great masters had burned the best arbors, along with the olive trees. In the afternoon, a sculptor came, proposing to replace the head of the great bronze harpy in the Plaza of Purification with one cast in Danny's image. She denied him with as much courtesy as she could muster. A pike of unprecedented size had been caught in the Skarhazardan, and the fisherman wished to give it to the queen. She admired the fish extravagantly, rewarded the fisherman with a purse of silver, and sent the pike to her kitchens. A coppersmith had fashioned her a suit of burnished rings to wear to war. She accepted it with fulsome thanks. It was lovely to behold, and all that burnished copper would flash prettily in the sun, though if actual battle threatened, she would sooner be clad in steel. Even a young girl who knew nothing of the ways of war knew that. The slippers the butcher king had sent her had grown too uncomfortable. Danny kicked them off and sat with one foot tucked beneath her and the other swinging back and forth. It was not a very regal pose, but she was tired of being regal. The crown had given her a headache, and her buttocks had gone to sleep.
"Sir Barristan," she called, "I know what quality a king needs most."
"Courage, or your grace?"
"Cheeks like iron," she teased. "All I do is sit."
"Your grace takes too much on herself. You should allow your counsellors to shoulder more of your burdens."
"I have too many counsellors and too few cushions."
Danny turned to Resnick.
"How many more?"
23, if it please your magnificence, with as many claims."
The seneschal consulted some papers.
"One calf and 3 goats. The rest will be sheep or lambs, no doubt."
"23,
Danny sighed.
"My dragons have developed a prodigious taste for mutton since we began to pay the shepherds for their kills. Have these claims been proven?"
"Some men have brought burnt bones."
"Men make fires. Men cook mutton. Burnt bones prove nothing. Bron Ben says there are red wolves in the hills outside the city, and jackals and wild dogs. Must we pay a good silver for every lamb that goes astray between Yunkai and the Skarhazardan?"
No, magnificence," Resnick bowed. "Shall I send these rascals away, or will you want them scourged?"
Daenerys shifted on the bench.
"No man should ever fear to come to me."
Some claims were false, she did not doubt, but more were genuine. Her dragons had grown too large to be content with rats and cats and dogs. "The more they eat, the larger they will grow," Sir Barristan had warned her. "And the larger they grow, the more they'll eat." Drogon especially ranged far afield, and could easily devour a sheep a day.
"Pay them for the value of their animals," she told Resnick, "but henceforth claimants must present themselves at the Temple of the Graces and swear a holy oath before the gods of Gis."
"It shall be done,"
Resnick turned to the petitioners.
"Her Magnificence the Queen has consented to compensate each of you for the animals you have lost," he told them in the Gascari tongue. "Present yourselves to my factors on the morrow, and you shall be paid in coin or kind, as you prefer."
The pronouncement was received in sullen silence.
"You would think they might be happier," Danny thought. "They have what they came for. Is there no way to please these people?"
One man lingered behind as the rest were filing out. A squat man with a wind-burned face, shabbily dressed. His hair was a cap of coarse red-black wire cropped about his ears, and in one hand he held a sad-cloth sack. He stood with his head down, gazing at the marble floor as if he had quite forgotten where he was.
"And what does this one want?"
Danny wondered.
"'Or kneel for Daenerys Stormborn, the Unburnt, Queen of Meereen, Queen of the Andals and the Rhoynar, and the First Men, Khaleesi of Great Grass Sea, Breaker of Shackles, and Mother of Dragons,' cried Miss Andy in her high, sweet voice. As Danny stood, her tokar began to slip. She caught it and tugged it back in place.
"'You with the sack,' she called. "'Did you wish to speak with us? You may approach.'
When he raised his head, his eyes were red and raw as open sores. Danny glimpsed of Barrison sliding closer, a white shadow at her side. The man approached in a stumbling shuffle, one step, then another, clutching his sack.
"'Is he drunk or ill?' she wondered.
There was dirt beneath his cracked yellow fingernails.
"'What is it?' Danny asked. "'Do you have some grievance to lay before us, some petition? What would you have of us?'
His tongue flicked nervously over chapped, cracked lips.
"'I brought bones,' she said impatiently. "'Burnt bones.'
He lifted the sack and spilled its contents on the marble. Bones they were, broken bones, and blackened. The longer ones had been cracked open for their marrow.
"'It were the black one,' the man said in a Gascari growl. "'The winged shadow. He come down from the sky and—and—'
"'No,' Danny shivered. "'No, no, oh no!'
"'Are you deaf, fool?'
Resnick Mo Resnick demanded of the man,
"'Did you not hear my pronouncement? See my factors on the morrow, and you shall be paid for your sheep.'
"'Resnick,' Sir Barristan said quietly,
"'hold your tongue and open your eyes. Those are no sheep bones.'
"'No,' Danny thought.
"'Those are the bones of a child.'
John. The white wolf raced to a black wood, beneath a pale cliff as tall as the sky. The moon ran with him, slipping through a tangle of bare branches overhead across the starry sky.
"'Snow!'
the moon murmured. The wolf made no answer. Snow crunched beneath his paws. The wind sighed through the trees. Far off he could hear his packmates calling to him. Like to like. They were hunting, too. A wild rain lashed down upon his black brother as he tore at the flesh of an enormous goat, washing the blood from his side where the goat's long horn had raked him. In another place, his little sister lifted her head to sing to the moon, and 100 small grey cousins broke off their hunt to sing with her. The hills were warmer where they were, and full of food. Many a night his sister's pack gorged on the flesh of sheep and cows and horses, the prey of men, and sometimes even on the flesh of man himself.
"'Snow!'
the moon called down again, cackling. The white wolf padded along the man trail beneath the icy cliff. The taste of blood was on his tongue, and his ears rang to the song of the 100 cousins. Once they had been 6, 5 whimpering blind in the snow beside their dead mother, sucking cool milk from her hard dead nipples whilst he crawled off alone. 4 remained, and 1 the white wolf could no longer sense.
"'Snow!'
the moon insisted. The white wolf ran from it, racing toward the cave of night where the sun had hidden, his breath frosting in the air. On starless nights, the great cliff was as black as stone, a darkness towering high above the wide world. But when the moon came out, it shimmered pale and icy as a frozen stream. The wolf's pelt was thick and shaggy, but when the wind blew along the ice, no fur could keep the chill out. On the other side, the wind was colder still, the wolf sensed. That was where his brother was, the grey brother, who smelled of summer.
Snow!
An icicle tumbled from a branch. The white wolf turned and bared his teeth.
Snow!
His fur rose bristling as the woods dissolved around him.
Snow! Snow! Snow!
He heard the beat of wings. Through the gloom, a raven flew. It landed on Jon Snow's chest with a thump and a scrabbling of claws.
Snow!
It screamed into his face. I hear you. The room was dim, his palate hard. Grey light leaked through the shutters, promising another bleak, cold day. Is this how you woke Mormont? Get your feathers out of my face. John wriggled an arm out from under his blankets to shoo the raven off. It was a big bird, old and bold and scruffy, utterly without fear.
Snow!
It cried, flapping to his bedpost.
Snow! Snow!
John filled his fist with a pillow and let fly. But the bird took to the air. The pillow struck the wall and burst, scattering stuffing everywhere, just as Dolorous Ed Tullet poked his head through the door. "Big pardon," he said, ignoring the flurry of feathers. "Shall I fetch me lord some breakfast?"
"Corn!" cried the raven. "Corn! Corn!"
"Roast raven," John suggested, "and half a pint of ale." Having a steward fetch and serve for him still felt strange. Not long ago, it would have been him fetching breakfast for Lord Commander Mormont.
"Three corns and one roast raven," said Dolores Head. "Very good, my lord, only hubs made boiled eggs, eh? Black sausage and apples stewed with prunes. The apples stewed with prunes are excellent, except for the prunes. I won't eat prunes myself. Well, there was one time when Hub chopped them up with chestnuts and carrots and hid them in a hen. Never trust a cook, me lord. They'll prune you when you least expect it."
Later. Breakfast could wait. Stannis could not. "Any trouble from the stockades last night?"
"Not since you put guards on the guards, me lord."
"Good." 1,000 wildlings had been penned up beyond the wall. The captives Stannis Baratheon had taken when his knights had smashed Mance Rayder's patchwork host. Many of the prisoners were women, and some of the guards had been sneaking them out to warm their beds. King's men, queen's men, it did not seem to matter. A few black brothers had tried the same thing. Men were men, and these were the only women for 1,000 leagues.
"Two more wildlings turn up to surrender," Ed went on. "A mother with a girl clinging to her skirts. She had a boy babe, too, all swaddled up in fur. But he was dead."
"Dead,"
said the raven. It was one of the bird's favorite words.
"Dead, dead, dead."
They had free folk drifting in most every night. Starved, half-frozen creatures who had run from the battle beneath the wall, only to call back when they realized there was no safe place to run to. "Was the mother question?" John asked. Stannis Baratheon had smashed Mance Rayder's host and made the king beyond the wall his captive, but the wildlings were still out there, the Weeper and Tormund Giantsbane and thousands more.
"Oi, my lord," said Ed, "but all she knows is that she ran off during the battle and hid in the woods after. We filled her full of porridge, sent her to the pens, and burnt the babe."
Burning dead children had ceased to trouble Jon Snow. Live ones were another matter. "Two kings to wake the dragon, the father first, then the son, so both die kings." The words had been murmured by one of the queen's men as Maester Aemon had cleaned his wounds. John had tried to dismiss them as his fever talking. Aemon had demurred.
"There is power in a king's blood," the old maester had warned, "and better men than Stannis have done worse things than this."
"The king can be harsh and unforgiving, aye, but a babe still on the breast? Only a monster would give a living child to the flames." John pissed in darkness, filling his chamber pot as the old bear's raven muttered complaints. The wolf dreams had been growing stronger, and he found himself remembering them even when awake. Ghost knows that Grey Wind is dead. Rob had died at the Twins, betrayed by men he'd believed his friends, and his wolf had perished with him. Bran and Rickon had been murdered too, beheaded at the behest of Theon Greyjoy, who had once been their Lord Father's ward. But if dreams did not lie, their direwolves had escaped. At Queen's Crown, one had come out of the darkness to save John's life.
Summer, it had to be. His fur was grey, and Shaggy Dog is black.
He wondered if some part of his dead brothers lived on inside their wolves. He filled his basin from a flagon of water beside his bed, washed his face and hands, donned a clean set of black woolens, laced up a black leather jerkin, and pulled on a pair of well-worn boots. Mormont's raven watched with shrewd black eyes, then fluttered to the window.
"Do you take me for your thrall?"
When John folded back the window with its thick diamond-shaped panes of yellow glass, the chill of the morning hit him in the face. He took a breath to clear away the cobwebs of the night as the raven flapped away. Ah, that bird is too clever by half. It had been the old bear's companion for years, but that had not stopped it from eating Mormont's face once he died. Outside his bedchamber, a flight of steps descended to a larger room, furnished with a scarred pinewood table and a dozen oak and leather chairs. With Stannis in the King's Tower and the Lord Commander's Tower burnt to a shell, John had established himself in Donal Noy's modest rooms behind the armory. In time, no doubt, he would need larger quarters, but for the moment these would serve, whilst he accustomed himself to command. The grant that the king had presented him for signature was on the table beneath the silver drinking cup that had once been Donal Noy's. The one-armed smith had left few personal effects, the cup, six pennies, and a copper star, a niello brooch with a broken clasp, a musty brocade doublet that bore the stag of Storm's End. His treasures were his tools, and the swords and knives he made. His life was at the forge. John moved the cup aside and read the parchment once again. "If I put my seal to this, I will forever be remembered as the Lord Commander who gave away the wall," he thought. "But if I should refuse..." Stannis Baratheon was proving to be a prickly guest, and a restless one. He had ridden down the King's Road almost as far as Queen's Crown, prowled through the empty hovels of Molestown, inspected the ruined forts at Queen's Gate and Oakenshield. Each night he walked atop the wall with Lady Melisandre, and during the days he visited the stockades, picking captives out for the Red Woman to question. He does not like to be balked. This would not be a pleasant morning, John feared. From the armory came a clatter of shields and swords, as the latest lot of boys and raw recruits armed themselves. He could hear the voice of Iron Emmet telling them to be quick about it. Cutter Pike had not been pleased to lose him, but the young ranger had a gift for training men. He loves to fight, and he'll teach his boys to love it too, or so he hoped. John's cloak hung on a peg by the door, his sword belt on another. He donned them both and made his way to the armory. The rug where Ghost slept was empty, he saw. Two guardsmen stood inside the doors, clad in black cloaks and iron half-helms, spears in their hands.
"Will my lord be wanting a tale?" asked Garth.
"I think I can find the King's Tower by myself." John hated having guards trailing after him everywhere he went. It made him feel like a mother duck leading a procession of ducklings. Arn Emmett's lads were well at it in the yard, blunted swords slamming into shields and ringing against one another. John stopped to watch a moment as Horse pressed Hop Robin back toward the well. Horse had the makings of a good fighter, he decided. He was strong and getting stronger, and his instincts were sound. Hop Robin was another tale. His club foot was bad enough, but he was afraid of getting hit as well. Perhaps we can make a steward of him. The fight ended abruptly, with Hop Robin on the ground. "Well fought," John said to Horse, "but you drop your shield too low when pressing an attack. You will want to correct that, or it is like to get you killed."
Yes, my lord. I'll keep an eye on next time."
Horse pulled Hop Robin to his feet, and the smaller boy made a clumsy bow. A few of Stannis' knights were sparring on the far side of the yard. King's men in one corner and Queen's men in another, John did not fail to note, but only a few. It's too cold for most of them. As he strode past them, a booming voice called after him, "Boy! You there! Boy!" Boy was not the worst of the things that Jon Snow had been called since being chosen Lord Commander. He ignored it.
"Snow!" the voice insisted. "Lord Commander!"
This time he stopped. "Sir?" The knight overtopped him by 6 inches.
"A man who bears Valyrian steel should use it for more than scratching his arse."
John had seen this one about the castle, a knight of great renown, to hear him tell it. During the battle beneath the wall, Sir Godfrey Faring had slain a fleeing giant, pounding after him on horseback and driving a lance through his back, then dismounting to hack off the creature's pitiful small head. The Queen's men had taken to calling him Godfrey the Giant Slayer. John remembered Ygritte crying, "I am the last of the giants. I use Longclaw when I must, sir." How well, though, Sir Godfrey drew his own blade. "Show us. I promise not to hurt you, lad." "How kind of you. Some other time, sir. I fear I have other duties just now."
"Oh, you fear? Ha! I see that."
Sir Godfrey grinned at his friends.
"He fears,"
he repeated, for the slow ones. "You will excuse me." John showed them his back. Castle Black seemed a bleak and forlorn place in the pale dawn light. "My command," John Snow reflected ruefully, "as much a ruin as it is a stronghold. The Lord Commander's tower was a shell, the common hall a pile of blackened timbers, and Harden's tower looked as if the next gust of wind would knock it over, though it had looked that way for years. Behind them rose the wall, immense, forbidding, frigid, a crawl with builders pushing up a new switchback stair to join the remnants of the old. They worked from dawn to dusk. Without the stair, there was no way to reach the top of the wall, save by winch. That would not serve if the wildlings should attack again. Above the King's Tower, the great golden battle standard of House Baratheon cracked like a whip from the roof where Jon Snow had prowled with bow in hand not long ago, slaying fens and free folk beside Satin and Deaf Dick Follard. 2 Queen's men stood shivering on the steps, their hands tucked up into their armpits and their spears leaning against the door. "Those cloth gloves will never serve," Jon told them. "See Burn Marsh on the morrow, and he'll give you each a pair of leather gloves lined with fur."
"We will, my lord, and thank you,"
said the older guard.
"That's if our bloody hands aren't froze off,"
the younger added, his breath of pale mist.
"I used to think that it got cold up in the Dornish marshes. Oh, what did I know?"
"Nothing," thought Jon Snow. "The same as me." Halfway up the winding steps, he came upon Samwell Tarly, headed down. "Are you coming from the king?" John asked him.
"Master Aemon sent me with a letter."
"I see. Some lords trusted their maesters to read their letters and convey the contents, but Stannis insisted on breaking the seals himself. How did Stannis take it?"
"Not happily, by his face." Sam dropped his voice to a whisper. "I am not supposed to speak of it."
"Then don't." John wondered which of his father's bannermen had refused King Stannis homage this time. He was quick enough to spread the word when Carhold declared for him. "How are you and your longbow getting on?"
"I found a good book about archery."
Sam frowned.
"Doing it is harder than reading about it, though. I get blisters."
"Keep at it. We may need your bow on the wall, if the others turn up some dark night."
"Oh, I hope not."
More guards stood outside the king's solar.
"No arms are allowed in his gracious presence, my lord,"
their sergeant said.
"I'll need that sword, your knives as well."
It would be no good to protest, John knew. He handed them his weaponry. Within the solar, the air was warm. Lady Melisandre was seated near the fire, her ruby glimmering against the pale skin of her throat. Ygritte had been kissed by fire. The Red Priestess was fire, and her hair was blood and flame. Stannis stood beside the rough-hewn table, where the old bear had once been wont to sit and take his meals. Covering the table was a large map of the north, painted on a ragged piece of hide. A tallow candle weighed down one end of it, a steel gauntlet the other. The king wore lamb's wool breeches and a quilted doublet, yet somehow he looked as stiff and uncomfortable as if he had been clad in plate and mail. His skin was pale leather, his beard cropped so short that it might have been painted on. A fringe about his temples was all that remained of his black hair. In his hand was a parchment with a broken seal of dark green wax. John took a knee. The king frowned at him and rattled the parchment angrily. "Rise. Tell me, who is Lyanna Mormont?"
"One of Lady Major's daughters, sire, the youngest. She was named for my lord father's sister."
"To curry your lord father's favour, I don't doubt. I know how that game is played. How old is this wretched girl child?" John had to think a moment. 10, or near enough, to make no matter. "Might I know how she has offended your grace?"
Stannis read from the letter. "Bear Island knows no king but the king in the north, whose name is Stark. A girl of 10, you say, and she presumes to scold her lawful king?" His close-cropped beard lay like a shadow over his hollow cheeks. "See that you keep these tidings to yourself, Lord Snow. Carhold is with me. That's all the men need to know. I will not have your brothers trading tales of how this child spat on me."
"As you command, sire." Mage Mormont had ridden south with Rob, John knew. Her eldest daughter had joined the young wolf's host as well. Even if both of them had died, however, Lady Mage had other daughters, some with children of their own. Had they gone with Rob as well? Surely Lady Mage would have left at least one of the older girls behind as Castellan. He did not understand why Lyanna should be writing Stannis, and could not help but wonder if the girl's answer might have been different, if the letter had been sealed with a direwolf instead of a crowned stag, and signed by John Stark, Lord of Winterfell.
It's too late for such misgivings. You made your choice.
2 score ravens were sent out, the king complained, yet we get no response but silence and defiance. Homage is the duty every leal subject owes his king.
Yet your father's bannermen all turn their backs on me, save the Karstarks.
Is Arnulf Karstark the only man of honour in the north? Arnulf Karstark was the late Lord Rickard's uncle. He had been made the castellan of Carhold when his nephew and his sons went south with Rob, and he had been the first to respond to King Stannis' call for homage, with a raven declaring his allegiance.
"The Karstarks have no other choice," John might have said.
Rickard Karstark had betrayed the direwolf and spilled the blood of lions. The stag was Carhold's only hope. In times as confused as these, even men of honour must wonder where their duty lies. Your grace is not the only king in the realm demanding homage.
Lady Melisandre stirred.
"Tell me, Lord Snow, where were these other kings when the wild people stormed your wall?"
"A thousand leagues away, and deaf to our need," John replied. "I have not forgotten that, my lady, nor will I. But my father's bannermen have wives and children to protect, and small folk who will die should they choose wrongly. His Grace asked much of them. Give them time, and you will have your answers."
"Answers such as this?"
Stannis crushed Lyanna's letter in his fist. "Even in the north men fear the wrath of Tywin Lannister. Boltons make bad enemies as well. It is not happenstance that put a flayed man on their banners. The north rode with Robb, bled with him, died for him. They have supped on grief and death, and now you come to offer them another serving? Do you blame them if they hang back? Forgive me, Your Grace, but some will look at you and see only another doomed pretender."
"If His Grace is doomed, your realm is doomed as well," said Lady Melisandre. "Remember that, Lord Snow. It is the one true king of Westeros who stands before you."
John kept his face a mask. "As you say, my lady." Stannis snorted.
"You spend your words as if everyone were a golden dragon. I wonder how much gold do you have laid by?"
"Gold? Are those the dragons the Red Woman means to wake? Dragons made of gold?" "Such taxes as we collect are paid in kind, Your Grace. The watch is rich in turnips, but poor in coin."
"Turnips are not like to appease Salador San. I require gold or silver."
"For that you need White Harbor. The city cannot compare to Old Town or King's Landing, but it is still a thriving port. Lord Manderley is the richest of my lord father's bannermen."
"Lord too fat to sit a horse."
The letter that Lord Wyman Manderley had sent back from White Harbor had spoken of his age and infirmity and little more. Stannis had commanded John not to speak of that one either.
"Perhaps his lordship would fancy a wilding wife," said Lady Melisandre. "Is this fat man married, Lord Snow?"
"His lady wife is long dead. Lord Wyman has two grown sons and grandchildren by the elder, and he is too fat to sit a horse. 30 stone, at least. Val would never have him."
"Just once, you might try to give me an answer that would please me, Lord Snow," the king grumbled.
"I would hope the truth would please you, sire. Your men call Val a princess, but to the free folk she is only the sister of their king's dead wife. If you force her to marry a man she does not want, she is like to slit his throat on their wedding night. Even if she accepts her husband, that does not mean the wildlings will follow him or you. The only man who can bind them to your cause is Mance Rayder."
"I know that," Stannis said, unhappily. "I've spent hours speaking with a man. He knows much and more of our true enemy, and there is cunning in him, I'll grant you. Even if he were to renounce his kingship, though, the man remains an oath-breaker. Suffer one deserter to live, and ye encourage others to desert. No. Laws should be made of iron, not of pudding. Mance Rayder's life is forfeit by every law of the Seven Kingdoms."
"The law ends at the wall, Your Grace. You can make good use of Mance."
"I mean to. I'll burn him,
and the North will see how I deal with turncloaks and traitors. I have other men to lead the wildlings, and I have Rayder's son, do not forget. Once the father dies, his whelp will be the king beyond the wall."
"Your Grace is mistaken."
"You know nothing, Jon Snow,"
Ygritte used to say. But he had learned. "The babe is no more a prince than Val is a princess. You do not become king beyond the wall because your father was."
"Good," said Stannis, "for I will suffer no other kings in Westeros. Have you signed the grant?"
"No, Your Grace."
"And now it comes."
John closed his burned fingers and opened them again. You ask too much.
Ask? I asked you to be Lord of Winterfell and Warden of the North. I require these castles.
We have ceded you the Night Fort.
Rats and ruins. It's a niggard's gift that costs the giver nothing. Your own man, Yarwick, says it will be half a year before the castle can be made fit for habitation.
The other forts are no better.
I know that. It makes no matter. They are all we have. There are 19 forts along the wall, and you have men in only 3 of them. I mean to have every one of them garrisoned again before the year is out.
I have no quarrel with that, sire. But it's being said that you also mean to grant these castles to your knights and lords, to hold as their own seats, as vassals to your grace.
Kings are expected to be open-handed to their followers. Did Lord Eddard teach his bastard nothing? Many of my knights and lords abandon rich lands and start castles in the south. Should their loyalty go unrewarded?
If your grace wishes to lose all of my lord father's bannermen, there is no more certain way than by giving northern halls to southern lords.
How can I lose men I do not have? I had hoped to bestow Winterfell on a Northman, you may recall, a son of Eddard Stark. He threw my offer in my face. Stannis Baratheon, with a grievance, was like a mastiff with a bone. He gnawed it down to splinters.
By right, Winterfell should go to my sister, Sansa.
Lady Lannister, you mean? You're so eager to see the imp perched on your father's seat. I promise you that will not happen whilst I live, Lord Snow.
John knew better than to press the point. Sire, some claim that you mean to grant lands and castles to Rattleshirt and the Magna of Thenn.
Who told you that?
The talk was all over Castle Black. If you must know, I had the tale from Gilly.
Who is Gilly?
The wet nurse, said Lady Melisandre. Your grace gave her freedom of the castle.
Not for running tales. She's wanted for a teats, not for a tongue. I'll have more milk from her, and fewer messages.
Castle Black needs no useless mouths, John agreed.
I'm sending Gilly south, on the next ship out of Eastwatch.
Melisandre touched the ruby at her neck.
Gilly is giving suck to Dala's son as well as her own. It seems cruel of you to part our little prince from his milk brother, my lord.
Careful now, careful.
Mother's milk is all they share. Gilly's son is larger and more robust. He kicks the prince and pinches him and shoves him from the breast.
Craster with his father, a cruel man and greedy, and blood tells.
The king was confused. I thought the wet nurse was this man Craster's daughter.
Wife and daughter both, your grace.
Craster married all his daughters. Gilly's boy was the fruit of their union. Her own father got this child on her.
Stannis sounded shocked.
You're well rid of her, then. I will not suffer such abominations here. This is not King's Landing.
I can find another wet nurse. If there's none amongst the wildlings, I will send to the mountain clans. Until such time, goat's milk should suffice for the boy, if it please your grace.
Poor fare for a prince, but better than a whore's milk, aye.
Stannis drummed his fingers on the map.
If we may return to the matter of these forts.
Your grace, said John, with chilly courtesy, I have housed your men and fed them, at dire cost to our winter stores. I have clothed them so they would not freeze.
Stannis was not appeased. Aye, you've shared your salt pork and porridge, and you've thrown us some black rags to keep us warm. Rags of wildlings would have taken off your corpses if I had not come north.
John ignored that. I have given you fodder for your horses, and once the stair is done, I will lend you builders to restore the night fort. I've even agreed to allow you to settle wildlings on the gift, which was given to the Night's Watch in perpetuity.
You offer me empty lands and desolations, yet deny me the castles I require to reward my lords and bannermen.
The Night's Watch built those castles, and the Night's Watch abandoned them to defend the wall. John finished stubbornly. Not a seats for Southron lords. The stones of those forts are mortared with the blood and bones of my brothers long dead. I cannot give them to you. Cannot or will not. The cords in the king's neck stood out sharp as swords. I offered you a name. I have a name, Your Grace. Snow? Was ever a name more ill-omened? Stannis touched his sword hilt. Just who do you imagine that you are? The watcher on the walls, the sword in the darkness. Don't prate your words at me. Stannis drew the blade he called Lightbringer. Here is your sword in the darkness. Light rippled up and down the blade, now red, now yellow, now orange, painting the king's face in harsh, bright hues. Even a green boy should be able to see that. Are you blind? No, sire, I agree these castles must be garrisoned. Oh, the boy commander agrees. How fortunate. By the Night's Watch. You do not have the men. Then give me men, sire. I will provide officers for each of the abandoned forts, seasoned commanders who know the wall and the lands beyond and how best to survive the coming winter. In return for all we have given you, grant me the men to fill out the garrisons, men-at-arms, crossbowmen, raw boys. I will even take your wounded and infirm. Stannis stared at him incredulously, then gave a bark of laughter. Hey, you're bold enough, Snow. I grant you that. But you're mad if you think my men will take the black. They can wear any colour cloak they choose, so long as they obey my officers as they would your own. The king was unmoved. I have knights and lords in my service, scions of noble houses, old in honour. They cannot be expected to serve under poachers, peasants, and murderers. Or bastard, sire? Your own hand is a smuggler. Was a smuggler. I shortened his fingers for that. They tell me that you are the 998th man to command the Night's Watch, Lord Snow. What do you think the 999th might say about these castles? The sight of your head and a spike might inspire him to be more helpful. The king laid his bright blade down on the map, along the wall, its steel shimmering like sunlight on water. You're only Lord Commander by my sufferance. You would do well to remember that. I'm Lord Commander because my brothers chose me. There were mornings when Jon Snow did not quite believe it himself, when he woke up thinking, surely this was some mad dream.
It's like putting on new clothes, Sam had told him. The fit feels strange at first, but once you've worn them for a while, you get to feeling comfortable.
Alistair Thorne complains about the manner of your choosing, and I cannot say he does not have a grievance. The map lay between them like a battleground, drenched by the colours of the glowing sword. The count was done by a blind man with your fat friend by his elbow, and Slint names you a turncloak. And who would know one better than Slint? A turncloak would tell you what you wish to hear, and betray you later. Your Grace knows that I was fairly chosen. My father always said you were a just man. Just but harsh had been Lord Eddard's exact words, but John did not think it would be wise to share that. Lord Eddard was no friend to me, but he was not without some sense. He would have given me these castles. Oh, never. I cannot speak to what my father might have done. I took an oath, Your Grace. The wall is mine. For now. We will see how well you hold it. Stannis pointed at him. Keep your ruins, as they mean so much to you. I promise you, though, if any remain empty when the year is out, I will take them, with your leave or without it. And if even one should fall to the foe, your head will soon follow. Now, get out. Lady Melisandre rose from her place near the hearth.
With your leave, sire, I will show Lord Snow back to his chambers.
Why? He knows the way. Stannis waved them both away. Do what you will. Devon, food, boiled eggs and lemon water.
After the warmth of the King Solar, the turnpike stair felt bone-chillingly cold.
"Wind's rising, milady,"
the sergeant warned Melisandre as he handed John back his weapons.
"You might want a warmer cloak."
"I have my faith to warm me."
The red woman walked beside John down the steps.
"His Grace is growing fond of you."
"I can tell. He only threatened to behead me twice." Melisandre laughed.
"It is his silences you should fear, not his words."
As they stepped out into the yard, the wind filled John's cloak and sent it flapping against her. The red priestess brushed the black wool aside and slipped her arm through his.
"It may be that you are not wrong about the Wilding King. I shall pray for the Lord of Light to send me guidance. When I gaze into the flames, I can see through stone and earth and find the truth within men's souls. I can speak to kings long dead and children not yet born, and watch the years and seasons flicker past until the end of days."
"Are your fires never wrong?"
"Never. Though we priests are mortal, and sometimes err, mistaking this must come for this may come."
John could feel her heat, even through his wool and boiled leather. The sight of them arm in arm was drawing curious looks.
"Oh, they will be whispering in the barracks tonight.
If you can truly see the morrow in your flames, tell me when and where the next Wilding attack will come." He slipped his arm free.
"Lore sends us what visions he will, but I shall seek for this man Tormund in the flames."
Melisandre's red lips curled into a smile.
"I have seen you in my fires, Jon Snow."
"Is that a threat, my lady? Do you mean to burn me too?"
"You mistake my meaning."
She gave him a searching look.
"I fear that I make you uneasy, Lord Snow."
Jon did not deny it. "The wall is no place for a woman."
"Oh, you're wrong. I've dreamed of your wall, Jon Snow. Great was the lore that raised it, and great the spells locked beneath its ice. We walk beneath one of the hinges of the world."
Melisandre gazed up at it, her breath a warm, moist cloud in the air.
"This is my place, as it is yours, and soon enough you may have grave need of me. Do not refuse my friendship, John. I have seen you in the storm, hard-pressed, with enemies on every side. You have so many enemies. Shall I tell you their names?"
"I know their names."
"Do not be so certain."
The ruby at Melisandre's throat gleamed redly.
"It is not the foes who curse you to your face that you must fear, but those who smile when you are looking and sharpen their knives when you turn your back. You would do well to keep your wolf close beside you. Ice, I see, and daggers in the dark, blood frozen red and hard, and naked steel. It was very cold."
"It is always cold on the wall."
"You think so?"
"I know so, my lady."
"Then you know nothing, Jon Snow," she whispered.
Bran.
"Are we there yet?"
Bran never said the words aloud, but they were often on his lips as the ragged company trudged through groves of ancient oaks and towering grey-green sentinels past gloomy soldier pines and bare brown chestnut trees.
"Are we near?"
the boy would wonder, as Hodor clambered up a stony slope, or descended into some dark crevice where drifts of dirty snow cracked beneath his feet.
"How much farther?"
he would think, as the great elk splashed across a half-frozen stream.
"How much longer? It's so cold. Where is the three-eyed crow?"
Swaying in his wicker basket on Hodor's back, the boy hunched down, ducking his head as the big stable boy passed beneath the limb of an oak. The snow was falling again, wet and heavy. Hodor walked with one eye frozen shut, his thick brown beard a tangle of
hoarfrost, icicles drooping from the ends of his bushy moustache. One gloved hand still clutched the rusty iron longsword he had taken from the crypts below Winterfell, and from time to time he would lash out at a branch, knocking loose a spray of snow. He would mutter, his teeth chattering. The sound was strangely reassuring. On their journey from Winterfell to the Wall, Bran and his companions had made the miles shorter by talking and telling tales. But it was different here. Even Hodor felt it. His Hodors came less often than they had south of the Wall. There was a stillness to this wood like nothing Bran had ever known before. Before the snows began, the north wind would swirl around them, and clouds of dead brown leaves would kick up from the ground with a faint, small rustling sound that reminded him of roaches scurrying in a cupboard. But now all the leaves were buried under a blanket of white. From time to time a raven would fly overhead, big black wings slapping against the cold air. Elsewise, the world was silent. Just ahead, the elk wove between the snowdrifts, with his head down, his huge rack of antler crusted with ice. The ranger sat astride his broad back, grim and silent. Cold Hands was the name the fat boy, Sam, had given him, for though the ranger's face was pale, his hands were black and hard as iron, and cold as iron, too. The rest of him was wrapped in layers of wool and boiled leather and ringmail, his features shadowed by his hooded cloak and a black woolen scarf about the lower half of his face. Behind the ranger, Mira Reed wrapped her arms around her brother to shelter him from the wind and cold with the warmth of her own body. A crust of frozen snot had formed below Jojen's nose, and from time to time he shivered violently.
"He looked so small," Bran thought, as he watched him sway. "He looks smaller than me now, and weaker too, and I'm the cripple."
Summer brought up the rear of their little band. The direwolf's breath frosted the forest air as he padded after them, still limping on the hind leg that had taken the arrow back at Queen's Crown. Bran felt the pain of the old wound whenever he slipped inside the big wolf's skin. Of late Bran wore Summer's body more often than his own. The wolf felt the bite of the cold, despite the thickness of his fur, but he could see farther and hear better and smell more than the boy in the basket, bundled up like a babe in swaddling clothes. Other times, when he was tired of being a wolf, Bran slept into Hodor's skin instead. The gentle giant would whimper when he felt him, and thrash his shaggy head from side to side, but not as violently as he had the first time back at Queen's Crown.
"He knows it's me," the boy liked to tell himself. "He's used to me by now."
Even so, he never felt comfortable inside Hodor's skin. The big stable boy never understood what was happening, and Bran could taste the fear at the back of his mouth. It was better inside Summer.
"I am him, and he is me. He feels what I feel."
Sometimes Bran could sense the direwolf sniffing after the elk, wondering if he could bring the great beast down. Summer had grown accustomed to horses at Winterfell, but this was an elk, and elk were prey. The direwolf could sense the warm blood coursing beneath the elk's shaggy hide. Just the smell was enough to make the slaver run from between his jaws, and when it did, Bran's mouth would water at the thought of rich, dark meat. From a nearby oak, a raven quawked, and Bran heard the sound of wings as another of the big black birds flapped down to land beside it. By day, only half a dozen ravens stayed with them, flitting from tree to tree or riding on the antlers of the elk. The rest of the murder flew ahead or lingered behind, but when the sun sank low, they would return, descending from the sky on night-black wings until every branch of every tree was thick with them, for yards around. Some would fly to the ranger and mutter at him, and it seemed to Bran that